This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Steph Donov, welcoming you to Everyday Health, an Audio Journal program in which we share information about healthy living. This broadcast is for informational purposes only, and suggestions should always be discussed with your healthcare providers. I don't know if anyone else has asked you this today, but are you happy with what happens when you go to the bathroom and take a pee? We'll look at why it is important to be happy with your pee and what you can do if you are not. Then we'll look at stress and at the science behind it. And finally, we'll be talking about cracking your knuckles. And is it good for you? Is it bad for you? Or does it make any difference whatsoever? But first, have you had a good pee lately? If not, this might help. Guardian writer Sarah Sloat talked to a number of experts on the subject, and this is what she learned to help us manage our urination and to debunk some of the misconceptions we might have about our trips to the bathroom. Urination is a vital human function and often occurs without much fanfare or thought. But age, sex, medication, and a host of other factors can influence how you use the bathroom. Because there can be so many variations, patients must not ignore what seems to be out of the norm for their own bodies. If something seems strange to you, one of the best things you can do is just go in and chat with your medical professional. Issues may stem from different phases of the bladder, such as urine storage, excretion, and what remains afterwards. Many urologists describe themselves to their patients as kind of human plumbers. When the plumbing is good in our homes, we don't think twice about it, but when something goes wrong, it can be terribly problematic. So let's start with some of the health habits experts recommend for managing urinary health. First, check the color of your urine. Hydration is essential for overall health, including digestion, metabolism, and cognitive function. When you're dehydrated, urine is more concentrated, which can irritate the bladder and increase the risk of urinary tract infections. You may have heard that you should drink 8 to 10 glasses of water a day. Not everyone agrees. Urine color is a much better indicator of your hydration levels. It will tell you a lot about your health. You want your urine to be a light yellow. Dark yellow suggests that you're dehydrated, and clear means you're consuming too much water. And if there's even a hint of blood in your urine, you need to speak to your healthcare provider. And next, do not hold your urine in excessively. The general rule is to urinate at least once every 3 to 4 hours. If you ignore the need to urinate, eventually your brain may start to ignore the signals that it's time to go. Over time, ignoring bladder signals can also cause the bladder to increase in size, making it less efficient. Some people are more likely to experience this because of demanding work issues. Doctors, nurses, police officers, firefighters, and teachers are often vulnerable. Frequently holding in urine also increases the risk of a urinary tract infection. When you hold your urine in for a long time, it is easier for the bacteria to multiply. Any kind of pain associated with urination, when holding in urine, while urinating, or after, should not be ignored. Simple testing can reveal whether there is an issue, such as an infection. Also, do not push too hard or hover over the seat. One of the biggest problems doctors see with patients is that they push to get every single little drop out. Putting that much pressure on the pelvic floor can weaken this group of muscles in the long term. Peeing just in case isn't necessarily a bad thing to do on occasion, but doing it so often that nothing comes out is inadvisable, as consistent pushing can also strain the muscles. Many people hover over a toilet seat to avoid contact, but this can put too much pressure on the pelvic floor. It is best to relax and urinate as much as you can. If there's a bit left over, that's fine. You don't have to be obsessed with getting to zero. But you should know how often you go. Certain medical conditions like bladder stones or diabetes might cause someone to urinate more than once every 3 to 4 hours. Specific bladder-irritating foods and drinks can lead to frequent peeing as well. If you're concerned about how often you need to pee, talk to a healthcare provider. But if you're overall healthy and urine comes out easily, it's probably fine to go as often as you want. If you feel the need to use the restroom more than 8 times a day and this is normal for you, it's unlikely that this frequent urination is damaging your bladder. However, habitual urination can be an issue if it is affecting your quality of life. It can take a toll on the individual and become a source of anxiety. For example, some people who need to urinate often may avoid working at their office or taking trips away from home. It can be paralyzing. People experiencing anxiety about frequent urination should start by speaking with their healthcare provider to be evaluated for any physical health issues. If everything checks out and anxiety persists, bladder training might be an option. This is a form of behavior therapy that can involve increasing the intervals between urinations and techniques like breath work and mindfulness. For example, the immediate urge to urinate can be experienced as a wave. When people need to learn to control their impulses to urinate, that feeling of need can go away if you wait it out and distract yourself. And remember that good bowel health is critical. A lot of people do not realize that bowel and bladder health are very interconnected. For example, people who have frequent constipation are prone to overactive bladder syndrome. They might have difficulty emptying their bladders, incontinence, or recurrent urinary tract infections. Staying hydrated is a strong foundation for bladder and bowel health. The right amount of water can vary for each individual, but a good rule of thumb is to drink when you're thirsty rather than aim for a target amount. And here's something else you can do. Eat fiber-rich foods and avoid bladder irritants. Because bowel and bladder health are connected, eating foods that support bowel health, high-fiber options like fruits and vegetables, is always recommended. Fiber-rich foods also lower the risk of diabetes, which is helpful because diabetes can eventually lead to bladder problems like incontinence. If you are experiencing urination issues, try cutting back on bladder irritants like coffee, soda, and wine. Chocolate, citrus fruits, artificial sweeteners, uncooked onions, spicy foods, and processed foods with artificial flavors can also irritate the bladder. Some research suggests that men who eat more red meat are at a higher risk of an enlarged prostate. This condition is associated with various bladder issues, including incomplete emptying, a weaker flow, and the frequent urge to urinate. While a weaker stream may seem like something you can ignore, men who experience this should speak with their healthcare provider. You might also want to consider pelvic floor exercises. At times, painful urination indicates an infection, but pain might also be a signal that you have a problem with your pelvic floor. Many gastroenterologists are sending their patients to pelvic floor therapy because the pelvic floor is not relaxing in a way that allows for the easy passage of stool contents. The pelvic floor is a group of muscles that runs from the pubic bone to the tailbone and supports the pelvic organs such as the bladder. It also supports the vagina and uterus in women and the prostate in men. Pelvic floor exercises can help with urinary incontinence or the involuntary leakage of urine. Exercises can include Kegels, engaging the pelvic floor when lifting weights, bridge lifts, squats, and diaphragmatic breathing. Because it is so easy to do Kegels incorrectly, Experts recommend speaking with your medical provider or physical therapist before you begin. Labor and delivery can cause straining and tearing of pelvic floor muscles. If you're considering pregnancy, it can help to start these strengthening exercises before becoming pregnant. During menopause, hormonal changes can weaken the pelvic floor muscles. Because a decline in estrogen can lead to bladder issues, timely postmenopausal topical vagina estrogen therapy is very important. For men, pelvic floor issues can manifest as incontinence, erectile dysfunction, and chronic pain. Among men, excess stress, cycling, heavy lifting, and constipation can lead to an overclenching of the pelvic muscles. At the beginning of this article, I asked you if you've had a satisfying pee lately. Well, I hope you have. But if you haven't, well, at least now you know what you can do that just might help. Happy peeing! Did you ever wonder exactly what stress does to your body? And when does it become a major problem? From an elevated heart rate to weakened immunity, experts explain the hidden physical cost of chronic stress and why our bodies are not built to stay on high alert. And here's what Joel Snape of The Guardian has to say about it after talking to those experts. You are undeniably stressed, and your body is likely to respond by ramping up the same biological systems that evolved millennium ago to deal with intertribal disputes and attacks by giant mammoths. But is there a downside to being stressed and having these systems switched on all the time? Well, take a calming breath, sit back, relax, and let us dig into the science of stress. Professor Kavita Vedhada, a specialist in stress and behavioral medicine at England's Cardiff University, tells us that the most immediate effect we see in a stressful situation is a surge of adrenaline causing an increase in heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing. This is your fight-or-flight response, and it is designed to prepare you to address the challenge you are facing. Within about 30 minutes of this rapid response, you will also experience a rise in cortisol, often known simply as the stress hormone. Again, this is very useful in supporting the fight-or-flight response, because it regulates blood pressure, suppresses the inflammation, and increases the availability of blood sugars to increase energy. This was all very useful centuries ago when most of what life threw at us was a physical challenge. But now it's fairly rare that we need to literally run away from or physically fight the source of our stress. And it's very easy for us to start worrying about someone being mean to us on the internet, or spend hours ruminating on an argument with our partner. The problem with this, broadly speaking, is that when your body diverts all of its resources to fight or flight, it's moving them away from areas such as digestion, repair, and the immune system, sometimes referred to as the rest and digest systems. This is fine if it happens occasionally. It's how we've evolved to operate. But if we're chronically stressed out, the body never gets time to catch up. Perhaps the most well-known issue associated with chronic stress is poor immune function, which can increase the risk of infections, make vaccines work less well, impair wound healing, and so on. But chronic stress has also been shown to increase the risk of obesity, depressive illness, and progression of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. Dr. Joe Daniels is a senior lecturer in psychology at England's University of Bath. She says that another issue is that all of this can create an unhealthy feedback loop. Because of the complex physiological nature of the stress response, we often experience a range of changes in the body. This in itself can become alarming for some people. Why is my heart beating so fast? This can then trigger increased attention to what are essentially normal body variations which effectively amplify those physiological sensations, adding another layer of stress and anxiety. When we're in a stress response, we're hypervigilant, so we're more likely to consider normal variations in our body sensations to be threatening. And because we are flooded with stress hormones, and we are using that ancient part of our brain that is programmed for survival, our decision-making is also likely to be impaired, so we might respond in ways that are not really that helpful. So let's say you're feeling a little on edge, for example. Well, because you're on edge, maybe you won't go out because it feels like your body is telling you something is going on here that we need to protect ourselves against. This brings us to the big question. How badly stressed and how frequently do you have to be stressed for all of this to be a concern? This is a question that scientists are still working on. The various stresses and stress responses and how we react to them is an elastic system. It is designed to respond and recover. How bad is it and how bad can it be? It is certainly true that the experience of stress has such a wide-ranging effect on our physiology that there is a potential for it to take a real toll on our health and well-being, but that's only true for long-term and enduring stressors. One near certainty is that more challenging lifestyle factors make stress more of a threat. In a landmark study in the 90s, for example, researchers recruited almost 400 healthy volunteers and then exposed them to a common cold. Yes, just a common cold. The researchers found that being stressed was heavily correlated with the tendency to become ill. The more stress they were under, the more likely they were to catch that cold. The experts say that a lot depends on your life experiences. People who have been affected by trauma might have a lower threshold for stress response, while other people seem to seek out stressful careers and thrive in them. It is also influenced by learned resilience and the ability to manage and respond to stress, though over a long term, as we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic, everyone has their limit. So what can you do to get better at managing stress? One of the most evidence-backed options, perhaps surprisingly, really is learning just to stop. Take a moment and slow your breathing. When people are stressed or anxious, they tend to breathe in a more shallow and rapid way, which reinforces the threat response, keeping the physiological loop going. If you breathe slowly, you're giving your brain the message that everything is okay, you are safe. Essentially, you are inducing the relaxation response. So something as simple as regulated breathing really can make a difference and head stress off at the pass. The same is true for exercise, which can help reduce the excess adrenaline buildup caused by high stress responses. It is important to understand that this is most useful in acute or temporary stress situations. Serious and disabling stress cannot be solved by just taking a breather. If the stress is more prolonged and frequent, another option is evidence-based psychological therapies, including cognitive behavioral therapy, known as CBT. When stressed and overwhelmed, we often jump to thoughts like, "I can't cope with this anymore." But is this true? Thoughts are not facts. A helpful strategy can be to sit down and assess the evidence. Have you coped with this before? Have you coped with anything worse? Can you survive the worst-case scenario if you are late for school drop-off or forget to feed the cat? It can also be useful to stop or phase out coping strategies that are not helpful and contribute to the problem. For example, some people tend to work longer or harder to try to solve a work-related problem, which is likely to contribute to increased stress over time. With mindfulness-based stress reduction techniques, the focus is different. You are taught skills to enable you to step back from unhelpful thoughts rather than challenge them. One option is to experiment with both, depending on the nature of what it is that is stressing you out. Are they negative thinking patterns and unhelpful coping strategies? These are often best tackled with CBT, while mindfulness-based stress reduction might be better for coping with the unavoidable stresses in your life. Avoiding stress completely, of course, is not a realistic option. Even those very, very few people who say they've never stressed out are probably just better able to manage challenging situations than the rest of us. The best thing to do, if you're concerned that you are suffering from high levels of stress all the time, is to understand and address the things that are causing it. This might be as simple as not going on social media first thing in the morning, or as difficult as changing your job or having a difficult conversation with your family. One thing the experts do know is the earlier you catch a stress problem, the easier it is to reverse it using simple strategies. But for chronic stress, modification to lifestyle, accessing social support, and developing helpful coping skills are the key. Experts suggest that people seek help when they find themselves experiencing stress most or all of the time, or if they themselves are concerned about their own stress levels. And remember, you cannot always control the giant mammoth charging you, but you can control how you respond to it. It is time for another old wives' tale, thanks to Kate Lloyd of The Guardian. She interviewed Dr. Kimmy Heirich, a rheumatologist and professor of epidemiology at the University of Manchester, to get the answer. Is it actually true that cracking your knuckles causes arthritis? Dr. Heirich says that this is a common question she gets asked over the dinner table. And it is no wonder, since as many as 54% of us are habitual knuckle crackers, regularly making those distinctive popping noises as we manipulate the joints. Heirich explains that the knuckle joint is a very tight space, and there's a little bit of fluid in it. When people crack their knuckles, they very temporarily enlarge the space. The pressure drops, and the gas that's dissolved in the fluid forms bubbles. And it's the bursting of those bubbles that cause the sound. The type of arthritis people tend to worry about is osteoarthritis, the most common form. It is a painful condition that causes swelling and stiffness in the joints and becomes more common as we age. We don't fully understand the cause, but genetics play a large part in it. Joint trauma is also a risk factor. It is probably this association with injury that fuels concerns about knuckle cracking. People are likely worried they're damaging their joint. But is there any actual harm? The doctor says no. Researchers have looked at people with and without arthritis and asked whether they crack their knuckles. There's been no difference. Others have compared people who do and don't crack their knuckles using x-rays. Again, no difference. Perhaps the most famous example is a U.S. physician who, in an effort to prove his mother wrong, cracked the knuckles on just one hand every day for over 60 years. When he finally had both hands assessed, there were no signs of arthritis in either of them. So what kind of trauma do increase your risk of osteoarthritis? Sporting injuries, such as breaking a bone near your joint or tearing ligaments. People who already have other kinds of arthritis, such as autoimmune condition rheumatoid arthritis, are also more prone to osteoarthritis. And her best advice for avoiding arthritis, maintain a healthy lifestyle, stay active, and keep to a healthy weight. Thank you for joining us today for Everyday Health. Our broadcast is for informational purposes only, and as I said at the start of the show, I am not a health professional. So please remember that you should always talk to your own healthcare providers when considering either starting or stopping doing something that could impact on your health or healthy living. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thank you again for listening, and we wish you health every day. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of the program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Steph Donoff. Thanks for listening, and be good to yourself.
And now, Medical Myths and Facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
Hantavirus is in the news. Yet another exotic virus capable of high rates of morbidity and mortality. Hantavirus is a rare but potentially very serious viral infection carried primarily by rodents. Humans usually become infected not from other people, but from exposure to rodent urine, saliva, or droppings, especially when contaminated dust becomes airborne. In the United States, the main carrier is the deer mouse. Now, most Americans have probably never heard of hantavirus until recently, when a highly unusual outbreak occurred aboard the luxury expedition cruise ship MV Hondius. In 2026, several passengers aboard the MV Hondius developed severe respiratory illness linked to hantavirus after a voyage connected to South America and Antarctic regions. Multiple deaths occurred, and passengers from more than 20 countries required evacuation, monitoring, and quarantine measures coordinated internationally. What made this especially important medically is that investigators suspected the Andes strain of hantavirus, one of the few forms known to allow limited person-to-person transmission under close contact conditions. Fortunately, experts emphasize this is not another COVID-like virus. Human-to-human transmission of hantavirus remains extremely uncommon. The outbreak drew global attention partly because hantavirus is ordinarily so rare in the United States. In fact, since surveillance began in 1993, the CDC has documented fewer than 900 confirmed U.S. cases total. Most years, the United States sees only a few dozen cases nationwide. By comparison, in the years 24 and 25, there were 16 million COVID illnesses in the United States, and as many as 50,000 deaths. In the United States, cases occur mainly in western states, such as New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, California, and Nevada. The classic exposure is not luxury travel. It is cleaning. Cabins, sheds, garages, barns, campsites where rodents have been present. One important teaching point is that sweeping or vacuuming rodent droppings can aerosolize viral particles and increase risk. Early symptoms tend to be nonspecific and can resemble flu or COVID: fever, muscle aches, fatigue, headache, nausea. Then in severe cases, patients can rapidly progress to cough, shortness of breath, pulmonary edema, shock, respiratory failure, and death. That rapid deterioration is what makes hantavirus pulmonary syndrome particularly feared. Although uncommon, hantavirus pulmonary syndrome carries a mortality rate historically around 30-40% in severe reported U.S. cases. There is no clearly proven antiviral therapy for advanced disease. Treatment is mainly supportive: oxygen, intensive care unit monitoring, mechanical ventilation, occasionally ECMO. Public health recommendations focus on rodent control and safe cleanup. Ventilate enclosed spaces before cleaning. Wear gloves and preferably an N95 mask. Spray disinfectant before wiping droppings. Avoid dry sweeping or vacuuming contaminated areas. The recent cruise ship outbreak reminded the world that zoonotic infections can still emerge unexpectedly, even in modern luxury travel settings. But the broader lesson is that hantavirus remains rare, geographically concentrated, and largely preventable through awareness of rodent exposure and proper cleanup precautions.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.